You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is February 19th, 2020. One of the constants of this show, this lecture series is what it is, and of my career in general, is the overall critique of modernism. The liberal democratic rule of science, very broadly considered, with the positivists being its purest expression. Criticizing that has been the core of my life. I did my doctoral dissertation on Michael Oakeshott's Critique of Modernity, and modernism being the ideology of modernity. And of course, centering on Thomas Hobbes, who was the founder of the modern way of thinking and one of its purest exponents. And it's what led me to this whole life and this whole world of thought. Now, in academia, it's now fashionable to criticize certain aspects of the modern world, even the scientific ideology. But it's accepted by academics only under really three conditions. First, that it doesn't reject the basic ideology of the modern world. The second is that it doesn't make any historical claims. In other words, it doesn't say that, the Middle Ages were morally superior or something like that. That would be out of the question. And lastly, that if it's going to be criticized, it has to be depicted as harming modernity itself, or some liberal good, like it harms equality, or more fashionably, that it has something bad to do with the environment. So because of those conditions, any kind of academic writing on like scientific ethics is usually, at best, it's humorous, at worst, it's misleading. So the environment is really the only way to criticize modernism in academia. Now, generally speaking, the scientific ideology, in its purest form, claims that it doesn't have any moral foundations. Like most of these myths, it has no real foundation. It rests on moral claims. And if it rests on moral claims, these are things that aren't directly scientific or empirical. Social life, of course, is loaded with morality. Without any normative claims, there's no reason to do anything. There's no reason to research anything. The very reason to become a scientist in the first place can't be scientific, according to this way of thinking. The fact that the sciences were brought into an economic relation to, like 19th century Great Britain, but that's not indicative of science as such. Ancient Egypt, ancient China, Babylon, Rome, these all had a high level of logical and mathematical knowledge, yet they never saw the need for a smartphone. But British nominalism, and of course the individualism that it's both based on and helped produce, removed science from its original trajectory, and it became a profitable enterprise, both in terms of building an empire, as well as producing products and claiming that they're necessities. It became an ideological movement in service both to the state and capital, and those have long since merged into one. it always had this tendency, but sometimes Victorian era, it developed into a very strictly maintained ideology in the service of the state and, of course, the middlemen who sold its creations. In other words, it became a stodgy defensive establishment and remains so today. Concepts of science are vague abstractions. There is only a scientific establishment. But there's two ways to see it. The first way is the exploration of creation, and an exploration of creation for the sake of specific needs and goals. There, it's quite legitimate. It's almost a liturgical act. Study of God's creation, it's almost an epiphany in itself. But then, there's science as techniques, a form of commodity production that then justifies exploitation in the name of progress. Vox Dei has a book, The Irrational Atheist, came out in 2008. He says this: modern science has only been around for the last roughly 350 years. If we date the scientific method back to the man known, the father of science, Galileo. One could push the date back considerably if one wished, Aristotle, forward to Newton. Regardless, the dire threat to mankind described by, and he cites several authors, only dates back to the middle of the 20th century. In the last 60 years, science has produced a veritable witch's brew of potential danger to the human race, ranging from atom-shattering explosive devices to lethal genetic modifications, designer diseases, large quantities of radioactive waste, and even, supposedly, the accidental production of mini black holes and strangelets through particle collider experiments. Now, I tend to bring science back to Thomas Hobbes, although they were more or less, they're both Renaissance figures. But what he says is true. Modern science has had a fairly short reign, but in this short period of time, it's come up with hundreds of ways to destroy humanity. You can't separate the modern scientific establishment from the millions slaughtered in World War I, World War II. And it's only matched by the massive increase in population that it's made possible. Now, of course, traditional ancient Christianity and the scientific way of thinking are not opposed. Science, both social and natural, takes from Christianity the moral drive to relieve suffering. And of course, it assumes natural law, not to mention social service. But none of those foundations could ever be justified by empirical methods. Christianity is served by science in that it the immensely complex world, for example, the genetic or the subatomic, reveals an all-powerful God. To this day, I'll never understand how evolution survived the discovery of DNA after World War II. The self-regulating nature of these ecosystems, not to mention the drive for self-preservation. God's obviously concerned with our well-being. It's very difficult to read the structure of DNA and how it operates and not believe in God. But it's certainly typical for Christians to be lectured by college kids that religion has been falsified by science or some other cliche. They usually don't know anything about either. These enthusiastic kids, of course, have their cynical professors, but of course they would recoil at what modern science does with their immense wealth and claims to omnipotence. The professors never bother to ask where the scientific mind should stop or what kind of questions they should not ask. Because as far as positivism is concerned, there is a very, it's very strictly defined. But today, of course, it's anything and everything. What is assumed right now, at least in pop culture, that if something can't be explained in terms of cause and effect, it must not exist. And this is taken for granted. But the end result of nominalism is the end of reason. And something like sociology is the science of human interaction and organization, or so they claim. They attempt to imitate the hard sciences. They want to uncover the underlying laws governing all social phenomena. The problem with this approach, of course, is that it seems to reject free will. And there's a strong sense that if these laws were real, then our will is just their appendage. But writers like Immanuel Kant or Durkheim, for example, bridge that gap, arguing that the social world could be modeled accurately, not based on iron laws of cause and effect, but by general proclivities. And it makes some sense, at least for the discipline of sociology. It could produce models to predict things without reducing the social world to a machine. Nevertheless, the social sciences are parasitic. It always irritated me. They take their concepts from history and philosophy, which are the two STEM fields. They take these concepts, they wildly simplify them, they give them new, overly academic-sounding names, and act like they created them. Anthropology differs in no way from history as a discipline, but it renames older core ideas as if they were just discovered. So Marxism becomes critical theory. Alienation becomes anomie. Ethno-nationalism is called boundary maintenance or fictive kinship entities. A rent is called negative reciprocity. Decentralized governments are called acephalous. Functionalism becomes integrationism. Paleoanthropology is a new name for the study of prehistory. Liberalism becomes rational choice theory. They take very old concepts and just give them new names. I taught an entire class on anthropological methodology not that long ago. And during the review session for the final, I had confessed to the class, I don't see how a single thing we've discussed differs from what I do every day as a historian. So the social sciences really are ideologically driven knockoffs of what used to be, of what were subfields of philosophy or history. It's ultimately everything is one of the two. So sociology is, one of the main social sciences. Opposes the Christian view of things, because it often argues that social life is self-contained and organized for the sake of secular purposes. They assume that there are no eternal moral laws. And I don't know how their methods permit them to know this, but they claim that one doesn't need God for the existence of social laws. But that is unscientific, and it represents the ideological side of these sciences. So Karl Marx, for example, used Ludwig Feuerbach, who was his main teacher, to argue that the gods were projections of an alienated mankind suffering under exploitation. Perfect justice, in other words, is projected outside of time since it can't exist inside it. Now, how Marx, being a materialist, can make sense out of exploitation as a bad thing is one of these problems. It's science with ideology. But somehow, a bad thing must be material. Now, theology, on the other hand, is defined in several ways. The cliché is that Western Christianity, what they mean is scholasticism in the High Middle Ages, stresses the logical elements of the faith, so it's seen as, in part, logical system of ideas, and therefore theology is the study of things divine, including scripture, church history, sacramental life, etc. Stereotype is also the East, it's more narrowly defined. It uses many of the same methods, but stressing the concept of experience as a foundation, and only the great saints, therefore, can be called a theologian. Since theology implies a knowledge of God, and knowledge derives from experience, only those in direct contact with the divine energies have anything to say about theology. So theology isn't really the study of church doctrine or history, but the purification of the mind, so we can see spiritual entities that are hidden in the carnal world. Now, these are stereotypes. There are hundreds of great mystics in the Western tradition, and many, many scholastics in the East. John of Damascus just being one. The distinction between scholastic theology and the mystic are very overdrawn. The mystic uses reason to understand experiences, the scholastics use reason to justify them. There's no difference between Athens and Jerusalem, or monasticism and humanism, or possessors and non-possessors. None of these dispensed with reason none dispense with direct experience. But these are the myths of modern social science and lazy history. Social philosophy, but not sociology, and theology, of course, are distinct, but they're not unrelated. I've said many times, the Synod of Chalcedon, 451, provides the general conception of their link, the general conception of how European peoples think of the world. I say that Chalcedon in 451 is the central event of European history. Now, since Christ has two natures, divine and human, and because of this, he has to have two wills, divinity irradiates matter, including human culture, of course, while matter becomes a receptacle of spirit. The separation of matter and spirit, or on the other hand, the separation of social life and divine truth, is artificial and is a result of sin. Christ, by uniting both natures, reunified the world of earthly goods and divine truth. So you can conclude, then, that social analysis, scientific investigation, and the desire for social harmony is just really doctrinal truth applied to social life. They're not real distinctions. It's what happens when labels take a life of their own. Science is inherently Christian because it assumes order. It assumes regularity and human survival as its minimum content. But the positivist has to explain, you know, the radical empiricist, the behaviorist. They have to explain how matter can exist without law. Law and matter have to be created at the same time, or else matter would dissolve. Matter is one thing, but its lawfulness is another. Science demands and assumes an orderly universe that seeks the survival of ecosystems that are necessary to it. So, to avoid the clear implication that this complexity is random, without purpose, is to stretch credulity to its limit. God can't be proven to exist because he's not an object among other objects. If he were, he'd be an idol. He's not an object at all. He can't be conceptualized or made the subject of logical analysis, although his effects, of course, can. On the other hand, lawfulness, the implicit purpose of matter, that's been an intellectual thorn in the side of modern science for a long time. Proving worldviews like materialism or nominalism is not in the realm of science. Yet scientific technique depends on the assumption of many non-scientific concepts. Logic is not self-justifying. To believe in the truths of logic isn't logical in and of itself. But the modern scientific mind, to this day, at least officially, claims a few things. They claim, number one, that there is no purpose to creation. It merely exists. Two, that meaning has to be granted to phenomena, and that meaning is granted by the establishment itself. And three, that nominalism is implicitly held as true. It doesn't have to be argued for. As most of you know, nominalism is a view that universal entities, universal concepts like justice or law, don't exist independently. And given that, meaning is not inherent in creation. There are no general ideas. Modern science rests on the nominalist assumption is difficult to deny. Without universals, though, there can be no natural law. And science has to fall back on faith and its own authority, and essentially general insulation from any kind of criticism. But the orthodox concept of logos, the presence of divine energy in nature, is the very origin of modern science, or of any science. Now, modern post-Christian science has been able to jettison all of this in favor of these impersonal mechanical laws without purpose, and these were certainly convenient in the age of revolution, but several centuries later, even that was questioned. You know, things like relativity, uncertainty, chaos became inconvenient for it. So where science stands in 2020 is indeterminate, but generally speaking, at least in the popular mind, it justifies itself through technology. In other words, scientific ideology must be true because we have iPhones. Now, the environmental movement, regardless of its power, its success, its failure, has been an elite, purely Western phenomenon for many decades. It is a wealthy and very powerful force. Since roughly 1990, climate change has been the central issue of this movement. It's probably a myth. It's odd how it developed right after the Cold War ended. But the elite that first created the issues that allegedly caused this problem and benefited from it want others to fix it. The philosopher of science at the University of Washington, Stephen Gardner, wrote a book in 2000, oh no, sorry, an article in 2004 called Ethics and Global Climate Change, which appears in the journal Ethics. And it's one of these criticisms that, as I mentioned in the beginning, has to follow the strictures. But academia is a hothouse environment with a captive audience, and that's not very conducive to anything serious. The pollutions are mostly within the rich nations of the world. It stands to reason that these same nations should pay the costs of its prevention, he would say. But then he actually argues that the economic impact of that would be minor. That seems, you know, to the ignorant, a good argument. Almost an airtight argument, right? But there's a problem here. What does the phrase rich nation refer to exactly? Who's going to pay for this? So the question then becomes, if the middle class of these countries, drowning in debt, and just forced to bail out the billionaires who invest in these polluting firms, are going to be gouged yet again to pay off yet another set of errors by the elite. No one denies that economic policy of these governments is made by a tiny elite. Even politicians don't make these investment decisions that cause these problems, whether they exist or not. The whole that the economy is doing well because of Clinton or Bush is an absurdity. Presidents have no power over the economy. He even asks the question. He says right there, concerning action against climate change. And this is from 2004. He says, what has the world done? The very fact this guy claims to be a professor of philosophy, and he uses ridiculous collective nouns with no referent, like the world. I mean, who speaks for the world? You know, there's an orthodox conception of the world, but that's very, very strictly defined. But whoever speaks for the world, it ain't the blue-collar guy in Detroit who just got laid off. So the minute you start using mystifications like this, immediately render the argument not just wrong, but unreadable. Rich nation, world, international community, they refer to nothing. Well, either that or he's abandoned nominalism, which I'm sure is not the case. But to the extent that these things exist at all, they're certainly controlled by a powerful elite that is not about to pay for its mistakes. So adding insult to intellectual injury, he has the gall to pompously announce that philosophical clarity is urgently needed. So, like all these guys, and this, of course, was written before Greta and that nonsense, the author assumes that global warming is incontrovertible and that nobody in the scientific community rejects its main thesis. Of course, this is far from true. As he well knows, the group that rejects that, specialists in the field, is growing. Now, since this argument came out roughly around the time I started college, the timeline for its Armageddon has come and gone. There's actually a small army of these guys who deny that this is occurring, or if it is, it's not uncommon. I remember distinctly when Al Gore said in the early 1990s, that by 2012 or 2014, the world would be flooded through the melting of the so-called polar ice caps. But the myth continues. The historical data, which is presently unchallenged as far as I know, show all manner of fluctuation. For many years, there's been work done on temperature trends. It's the trendiest thing right now. But if you want grant money, you better say the right things. But warming and cooling are the normal cycle of the Earth, regardless of any human action. The journal Geophysics Research Letters, D.R. Easterling wrote this. He said, the reality of the climate system is that due to natural climate variability, it's entirely possible to have a period as long as a decade or two of cooling superimposed on the longer-term warming trend due to anthropogenic greenhouse gas forcing. climate scientists pay little attention to these short-term fluctuations, as the short-term cooling trends mentioned above are insignificant, and fitting trends of such short periods is not meaningful in the context of long-term climate change. On the other hand, segments of the general public do pay attention to these fluctuations, and some critics cite the most recent period as evidence against the idea of climate change. And he said that in 2009. Now, that, by the way, is the introduction to his work on global cooling. There's as much evidence for that as there is global warming. There's no causal connection between greenhouse gases of all sorts and global warming. Fluctuations were well known long before industrialization. But the overarching argument that Easterling makes is that there's no trend. Cycles are dominant historically, not catastrophe. Robinson, elsewhere, says, the overall experimental record is self-consistent. The Earth has been warming as it recovers from a little ice age at an average rate of about 0.5 centigrade per century. Fluctuations within this temperature trend include periods of more rapid increase and periods of temperature decrease. These fluctuations correlate well with concomitant fluctuations in the activity of the sun. Neither the trends nor the fluctuations within these trends correlate with hydrocarbon use. Sea level and glacier length reveal three intermediate uptrends and two downtrends since 1800, as does solar activity. These trends are climatically benign and result from natural processes. And that was written in 2007 in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons. Now, I mentioned this not to, you know, this isn't about global warming. But there was a book in 1971 called Global Ecology, Readings Towards a Rational Strategy for Man. Any book that has, you know, anything about man or mankind in it, you know, especially by a major academic press. But he wrote, this is the year I was born, 71. It's Reed Bryson. He said, continued rapid cooling of the Earth since World War II is in accord with the increase in global air pollution associated with industrialization, mechanization, urbanization, and exploding population. That was the scientific idea of the day. But if they were incorrect, then the global warming scare that I first heard about in 1990 may well be wrong too. The citation that from Bryson I just mentioned uses the same models that are used today, with all their flaws and limitations. Around the time the book was written, there was a sudden drop in global temperatures. And that's where the so-called Ice Age thesis in the 70s came into existence. But even if they're right, are the wealthy and the rich countries going to pay for this? They didn't pay for the mortgage meltdown, so why this? Guys like Professor Gardner have been in academia too long. They're cut off from the real world. But using collective nouns bring his logical ability into question. For anomalists to use a collective noun to be automatically dishonest. But this guy, no doubt, lectures on the importance of critical thinking, doesn't even bring up these issues. He's got a great job, there's no doubt. But beyond the use of these words that don't refer to anything, talk about things like the depletion of fossil fuels, or the fuels needed for industrialization in general. The implications that the third world needs to industrialize, but since the West uses so much of these non-renewable fuels, it will be far too expensive for the poorer states to do the same. But if he's so concerned with global warming and these issues, why would he want the mass industrialization of the third world? He could argue that rich countries, as countries, should not pay for the cleanup of anything, since the overwhelming majority of the people alive in these societies today, A, were not alive when Britain and the Netherlands industrialized, B, have had nothing to do with economic decisions, and certainly C, have nothing to do with industrial policy today. So forcing someone to pay for the errors of others is unjust. And this is why he uses empty collective nouns like the world community. Now, no one's saying that Argentina or Togo should pay. It's just that the middle class, who has no influence over any of these policies, certainly shouldn't be gouged again. Now, if Mr. Gardner can assure us that the board of Goldman Sachs and Exxon will have to sell their summer homes to pay for these problems, then we're all for it. But, of course, he cannot. He doesn't seem to realize that's a problem. Then, the argument that since Americans consume in massive quantities, they're responsible for all this alleged environmental disaster. But even if the American consumer bought goods from all these polluters directly, it doesn't directly involve them with pollution. We buy some of these things because we have to. The firms may be responsible. But even if we could show that consumers are partly culpable, it's still problematic since mass consumption didn't really take its cataclysmic form until really the late 1950s, the advent of the credit card, or, you know, credit for the common man. The elite have revolutionized post-war society, whether we elect it or not. Therefore, how can the middle classes be responsible? Gardner also, like so many of these guys, seems to be very cavalier about coercion. In pages 594, 595 of this, he speaks of a very nebulous global authority that will force the rich countries to pay their fair share. Who are these people? Is it the phantom international community? He skirts the issue entirely. It's merely assumed that some global agency will be duly empowered by somebody to shake down Joe Sixpack. And yet again, the ethical issues escape him. What if the fact that dozens of countries in the Third World, using technology developed in the West, are becoming wealthy trade rivals of the U.S.? It was European Western workers who built the first cars, trains, steam engines, and these workers were exploited in the process. Now today, their own exploitation is being globalized. So China, Thailand, Korea can rapidly become first world states by, in essence, expropriating the labor of generations of Americans and Englishmen. So now they're exploited twice. It's bad enough that the parasitic bankers profited off the labor of these European blue-collar workers over the last 100 years. Now their effort is going to make others wealthy outside the country. So the same nouveau riche in China or Brazil now demand that the descendants of these workers pay more for the mess they made in creating the conditions of the Third World is dying to emulate in the first place. But that a philosopher in a big state university can't even understand these basic logical issues and problems gives you a bit of a clue about the condition of modern academia, especially when it comes to things like science, which is very fashionable today. There's another one. Morton Winston, who died in 2017, another one of these philosophy professors at the College of New Jersey. He wrote a book with Ralph Edelbach in 2013 called Society, Ethics, and Technology. But his argument begins with an inexcusable error, that ethical theory has concerned itself primarily with individuals and not social consequences. That's what he says on page 17. That's silly. Plato, Augustine, Aquinas, they concerned themselves with social consequences of the human desire to rule and control. It's just that modernity didn't listen to them. In fact, modernity rejected them. But Winston describes what everyone knows, that technology and the scientific control over nature has some nasty consequences. What he can't fathom, and this is again one of the conditions of being allowed to criticize this stuff in academia, about 1,500 years ago, Greek writers like Basil of Caesarea, Ambrose of Salon, Gregory of Nyssa, spoke at length of the destruction that egocentrism, self-interest, and private capital can create in society. They argued that it debases the will, that the wealthy and powerful, that they're insatiable. Even dominance over productive forces distorts the profiteer's view of the natural world. Ambrose says that explicitly. In fact, the ancient writings these guys don't read sound very modern. Modernity based itself on Locke and Hobbes. Now, hundreds of years later, the dons of academia decide that modernity and the Enlightenment are morally problematic. Needless to say, they will not repudiate the assumptions of the early Enlightenment because they'll be called obscurantists if they do. So they exist in some kind of intellectual limbo. So the evils that these guys are railing against are from the mentality of the Enlightenment. When, you know, modern science developed, and claim that it alone can give meaning to nature, not to mention human life and value in general. He then explains, and this is that food is going to run out soon because the globe's population explodes. You know, that he's still making that stupid argument, that old saw, which has been destroyed hundreds of times. Has he not noticed that the overwhelming majority of arable land in the world is empty? That most of the inhabitable land in the world is empty? The fact is that the full overwhelming productive capacity of two or three American states would so depress the food market that prices for these commodities would approach nothing. And that argument may have worked, you know, in the 19th century, but apparently, unbeknownst to this guy, there's been an explosion of agricultural production that in fact forces governments to pay farmers not to farm. There is way too much food. These guys are used to pontificating to a captive audience. Scholars like Winston, they've forgotten the basics of critical thinking. You know, this is a ritualized ideological agreement at the faculty cocktail lounge. And there's no substitute for rigorous criticism. He says this. He says, there is increasing evidence that our technological society is rapidly transforming the Earth's environment, and probably not for the better. He says on page 16. And he writes this as if it were revelation, expecting us to be shocked at his ability to discern the unintended consequences of Hobbes' materialism. Other comments that technologies are not value neutral. He says this like it was just discovered yesterday. But this has been argued for centuries in the literature that he's ignorant of, opposing the science of the Enlightenment. The English, Irish, and Southern agrarians, even better known writers like Emerson or Thoreau, conservatives like Bonald or Danilevsky, 19th century Russian Slavophiles, and an army of the centralist anti-modernist writers, even early Rousseau, made identical arguments 200 years ago, and more. And yet he states these insights as if he just concocted them in his office. Well, he talks about an informed democracy, and if this is what he means, then he's ignoring several centuries of anti-technological and anti-modern writing going back to the English Civil War, going back to Gerald Winstanley. Moderns, the scientific establishment, and the economic elites dismiss these people as cranks, but religious fanatics, obscurantists, standing in the way of the inevitable progress to the Baconian New Atlantis. If Winston is right, then the Enlightenment is wrong. That's the problem all of these guys face. They can't go out and say the Enlightenment is wrong. So, as I said, they exist in this weird intellectual limbo that I don't envy. But the people who rule us, this is one thing that left and right agree on, their fortunes are secure, they have billions invested to control the very democracy that will save us, allegedly, are now decided that their forebears might have been incorrect on a few particulars. But of course, repudiating modernity is out of the question, but they still feel it necessary to express regret concerning some of their unintended externalities. It is pseudo-critical dishonesty. You know, the fact that he says that the rise in the standard of living through technology has unintended consequences. You know, look, mass society ruled by a handful of media elites and corporate parasites has no ability to rouse itself and suddenly inform themselves that technology has changed things. There's certainly no reason to believe that even if well-informed, they'll do anything. There's even less reason to believe that the broad masses are motivated by truth claims at all. But this is completely besides the fact that liberal democracy has no economic role. It's a political process with a guaranteed outcome. It's a process, a mechanism that could bring anyone or anything to prominence, not an ethical theory in and of itself. And he seems innocent of the fact that governments are controlled by finance, capital, bureaucracy, and courts. Actual politicians have almost no say over how policy is passed, implemented, or accepted, and no system or ideology in a country of 300 million people can empower the anonymous individual. People like Winston, well, and his students need to be reminded that you have, you're looking at a $20 trillion public sector debt and about the same in private sector debt, not including interest. So are these the same people who are going to use their democratic rights to save us from corporate greed? It takes very little time to go to the webpages of the big NGOs that Winston mentioned at the end of his startling revelation. These NGOs are financed by the same companies that often finance scientific academic research in the first place. The World Wildlife Fund, everyone's seen that stupid sticker around. The WWF has its own director for corporate relations and takes money from, and this I wrote this actually in 2013, over 100 major global corporations. It's a great article, Tony Cartolucci. I've quoted him many times here before. In 2013, he says this. He says, the World Wildlife Fund and its Earth Hour, for instance, includes Fortune 500 corporations, Walmart, Unilever, Coca-Cola, draconian intellectual property racketeer Christopher Dodd, representing the Motion Picture Association of America as a director, Bank of America, Google, and many others. Well, the WWF claims to have having big corporate partners is good news for the environment, implying they're shifting towards environmental responsibility. In reality, it's the other way around. Corporations are co-opting genuine concern to further enrich themselves and create global frameworks that eliminate indigenous competition over resources they themselves were already exploiting and plan to continue exploiting. So, democracy is the rule of money. Obviously, since it costs a fortune to run for any office of any significance. The individual, which, by the way, is another non-existent abstraction, can't make a difference in an oligarchy by rushing to the polls and voting for the media-approved candidate. But the argument really can't be refuted because there's no evidence offered. Nor is the vocabulary precise enough to summarize what the argument was meant to show in the first place. Abstractions like democracy, rights, individuals, the world community, they don't mean anything in the context that Winston uses them. Or any of these guys. Scientific liberal democracy has been the official ideology of the Western world for 150 years at least. And it's precisely now that the evils it has recently discovered occurred. What these guys don't grasp is that political democracy, which is, by the way, a very cumbersome process based on compromise, financial interest, has nothing to do with private investment decisions. Unless he's advocating a total nationalization of the globe's manufacturing and chemical concerns, his argument, like all of these guys, is a conga line of non sequiturs, cliches, overly abstract vocabulary, and mismatched levels of analysis. The issue, of course, beyond all of this, is standardization and control. Kimbrell writes in 2000, he says, the fundamental principle of agriculture is that it deals with life, that is to say, living substance. Its products are the results or processes of life, and its means of production is a living soil. A cubic centimeter of fertile soil contains billions of living organisms, the full exploration of which is far beyond the capacities of man. The fundamental principle of modern industry, on the other hand, is that it deals with man-devised processes, which work reliably only when applied to man-devised non-living materials. The ideal of industry is the elimination of living substances. Man-made materials are preferable to natural materials because we can make them to measure and apply perfect quality control. The ideal of industry is to eliminate the living factor, even including the human factor, and to turn productive forces over to machines. In other words, there can be no doubt that the fundamental principle of agriculture and of industry, far from being compatible with each other, are in fact in opposition. And that's from his 2000 book, Cold Evil, Technology and Modern Ethics. But the issue certainly is standardization and control. Now, in theory, most people will tell you that they're opposed to this kind of thing. You know, the boomer feminist at the yoga studio believes he's fighting toxic masculinity, typified in both machines and rational cognition. But Kimbrell's point is the mentality behind modern industry, never before seen in Western life until the modern era, is that the organic is the problem to be overcome, not something to be assisted or improved. Now, it could go one of several ways. You could claim, for example, that, you know, talking about modern science, well, people are more connected than ever before. Communications are much easier. Well, we can't get lost because GPS satellites watch our every move. Things like DNA technology have made solving crime as much easier. And innocent people have been sprung from prison. Education is easier. Can be done online. No one questions the medical advances due to technology. Doctors can use lasers rather than scalpels. DNA can be used to identify the origin of disease. Crops can be protected from fungus. You could also make the point that labor is much easier. Technology has taken tasks that took days to accomplish and made it able to be done in a person of below average ability in a few minutes. Of course, the less physical work, the fatter the population, the strides of modern medicine are necessarily, the strides of modern medicine are necessary due to the evils of modernity. They're solving problems that they created. The myth of the vaccine, that these vaccines wiped out the disease that was disappearing to begin with. And in some cases, they simply changed the name. Even bring that into question. Scientific progress has given us poison gas, machine gun, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, surveillance techniques, the modern state. We can conveniently, well, I don't know. I mean, what's a conservative estimate of World War One? You know, World War Two, what, 60 million? 100 people are killed on the road every day in automobiles. Hundreds of thousands killed in factories throughout the 19th and 20th century. Probably far more than that. Deaths from airplane accidents, drug overdoses, a billion other causes deriving from modern science. And just consider things like fast food, food additives, psychotropic medications. So you have to argue then that our technological society is worth the sacrifice of, I don't know, 500 to 700 million people over the last 150 years. That's, you know, unfortunately, something that defenders of the modern world have to take seriously. I mean, even something as wonderful as air conditioning, the only thing that ever had me question my anti-modern point of view, invented by A.J. Lubbs at the University of Nebraska, by the way, even if something as wonderful as air conditioning means that fewer families sit outside in the summer. There's actually a group of articles some years ago saying that air conditioning meant that community was destroyed because in the summertime, especially down south, people would sit outside in the summer. And this was a big conductor of community. Air conditioning means that homes aren't built with the big front porches anymore. The point that Michael Hoffman made some years ago is that progress is impossible because when something is gained, a piece of knowledge or a technique is gained, something is lost. Now, we know that labor-saving devices don't make anything easier, just more is expected of you. Labor productivity has gone through the roof, that's very true, but they're not being paid accordingly. There's one estimate that if in 1966, the minimum wage was $1.60, I believe. There's more than one article out there that calculates that if the minimum wage kept up with labor productivity, which makes sense, right? You should be paid by what you produce. The minimum wage should be almost $70 an hour. Well, that means there's a lot of surplus product that labor creates that has, what, disappeared? Where has it gone? It seems that over time, progress evens out to zero. Now, of course, there's a legitimate man of science, and he not need be a materialist. The scientific revolution often had clergy all over the place. Just because a scientist is trained to observe a certain aspect of matter, it doesn't follow that matter is all there is. Now, it certainly serves the establishment that that's the case. since that also means that morals can't exist and the power of science is limitless. That's the very pathway for totalitarianism. If everything is material cause and effect, in one way or another, that means everything is amenable to scientific regulation. There is no such thing as science. It's one of these meaningless collective nouns. But it's a mythical concept in that it evokes images of brilliance and reason. There is no science, but there is a scientific establishment. That evokes something else. But that's what most men of science actually do. They're part of large bureaucratic machines, and they have zero chance of making any sort of path-breaking discovery. Even if they did, they wouldn't get any credit for it. The company would. They work for profit-seeking corporations that require the scientific method when it's profitable. The overwhelming majority of doctoral degree earners in those fields are either working for large corporations or the state. So that by itself destroys the abstract science concept. It can't exist. Self-interest, not abstract ideals, both created the scientific method, and it also created the rules to that end, to what end it should be put. Technology is not this inevitable march, but it's in the interest of capital that it's thought to be so. Technology is imposed. We had no idea the death toll of the automobile when it first was invented. Concepts like markets or progress or empowerment, also empty abstractions, they come to justify what's already come to pass. It's an ex post facto rationalization. The grid is simply too expensive to maintain. Western governments and consumers have no money, and the debt is too high. Because of that, any shock to the system may bring it crashing down. What people don't realize is that millions are opting out of this system, and the means to do this, going off-grid, etc., are becoming easier, more affordable, and more in reach. But more people are questioning modernity now than ever before, and with greater sophistication. I mean, if the environment or the trendy way gets started, then fine. The dollar has an expiration date, soon to arrive. When the dollar's gone, the grid goes along with it. Progress is never linear. Nothing ever is linear. Linear development is artificial. But modernism loves to believe that it's based on science. And that's what justifies the modern era. But this abstraction has no real presuppositions in their mind. But it's a major assumption of the system that it has no assumptions. It's an illusion. Modernity and the scientific progress upon which it's based has many presuppositions. But these presuppositions are significant because they have no scientific basis. So, for example, progress is always defined in technological or financial terms. Social control is no longer in the hands of governments, but specialists, technicians, managers, financiers. Science is not amoral, but tightly connected to ideologies, positivism and nominalism. Science is considered a value in and of itself. It romanticizes itself as the only way to truth. It assumes that all is matter. But if all is matter, then the commodification of humanity is equally non-problematic. On what ground do you resist this stuff? The individual, of course, is seen as the only reality, but this is untenable. Even scientifically, it's untenable, because any individual, like an individual person, is in fact a collection of chemical, electric forces. They could be broken down even further. Of course, matter is imperfect. It resists human control. Therefore, in order to improve the world, it has to be brought under control by force. Because it has no purpose in and of itself, forces of nature have to be harnessed for human needs, or that is, that of the elite. In their mind, nothing has any ultimate meaning or absolute significance. None of these fundamental beliefs has ever been debated until long after they've appeared. The scientific truths, so-called, that created the that created the Industrial Revolution are largely rejected now. So the defeat of traditional society centuries ago was won under false pretenses, because those theories of science that overthrew the Baroque era, for example, are now considered laughable. So on what basis was the Middle Ages overthrown? And of course, we all know science is completely free from popular control, but certainly not that of the state or corporate controllers. And of course, economics is the master science. Now, that's not an exhaustive list by any means. I have a more exhaustive list in other places, but that's the introductory list of assumptions that the modern world, those defending the modern system, have to make. One of my favorite writers on this topic, Jacques Ellul, in his, even Lewis Mumford, in 1964, he said the following. He said, "The bargain we're being asked to ratify takes the form of a magnificent bribe. Under the democratic authoritarian social contract, each member of the community may claim every material advantage, every intellectual and emotional stimulus he may desire, in quantities hardly available hitherto, even for a restricted minority, food, housing, fast transportation, instantaneous communication, medical care, entertainment, education, but on one condition. One must not merely ask for nothing that the system does not provide, but likewise agree to take everything offered, duly processed and fabricated, homogenized and equalized, in the precise quantities that the system, other than the person, requires." Progress seems to have one clear direction, but that direction wasn't known at the start. So they could talk about democracy all they want, but it doesn't make any sense when it's the few who actually choose what technologies will develop and which will not. That technicians, bankers, media actually rule the day. And then costs continue to rise beyond the economy's ability to repay. With every development of technology, several things occur. First, the cost of maintaining the grid rise, that is, that interlocking system of institutions needed to maintain the technological system. It's a system. You can't have one smartphone. It's a system of domination. The other thing is that mankind then forgets something that it used to do prior to the advent of the technology. So for each new development, costs will rise. Whatever the progressive elements that might be adopted, they're regressive ones. So as I've said, many others, progress simply does not exist. But technocracy grew in the same context as liberalism, and the two were intertwined. I've quoted this before, but Alexander Dugin, in The Fourth Political Theory, in 2012, has one of the best lines on this phenomenon. He says, "Having triumphed, liberalism disappears and turns into a different entity, into post-liberalism. It no longer has political dimensions, nor does it represent free choice, but instead becomes a kind of historically determined destiny. This is the source of the thesis of post-industrial society. Economics is destiny. The status quo and this inertia do not presuppose any political theory whatsoever. A global world can only be ruled by laws of economics and the universal morality of so-called human rights. All political decisions are replaced by technical ones, machinery and technology substitute for all else." Leon Kass, the chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics in 2013, said, and this is pretty shocking for a mainstream scholar, says, "There's no need for world controllers. Just give us a technological imperative, liberal democratic society, compassionate humanitarianism, moral pluralism, and free markets. We will take ourselves into a brave new world all by ourselves, without even deliberately deciding to go. In case you hadn't noticed, the train has already left the station and is gathering speed, and no one seems to be in charge." Now, he wrote that earlier, in 2001, but it's a studied naivete. I started off this talk talking about the conditions under which you can criticize this stuff, and well, this is part of the problem. There are no world controllers. It's tantamount to saying that there are those on the globe that there's no one in the globe whose control over markets function exactly as they they create, not follow, market forces. Major banks who manipulate global foreign exchange values is just one example. There's no moral pluralism there. To say that no one's in charge is absurd. It's not a random process. He's saying essentially that there's no one who has an overriding financial or professional interest in its promotion. But to say that would be to violate the conditions under which modern technocracy can be criticized in academia. They're only allowed to go so far. And if you read enough, there's brilliant guys like Gerrymander. You see that they want to go to that next step, but they know that they can't, so they have to hold back, and their articles always seem unfinished. It's one of the reasons I don't envy these guys. Well, guys like me, thanks to listeners like you, can do what they can't. We could say the things that would get them into a lot of trouble. They wouldn't necessarily get fired, but their lives would be made very miserable. I know the pressures on academics. I felt them myself. When you have a great job, little work, and six-figure salaries, job security, summers off, travel money, all the rest of it, all the prestige that goes along with it, it's really easy to say to yourself, well, I can't control anything. If it's not me, it would be someone else. There's nothing I can do. So I might as well just fight them from within or some rationalization like that. And that's what they do. They're not actually criticizing anything seriously because they're in this straitjacket. The environmentalist movement is, generally speaking, wrong. But the foundations that they start from are correct. That the Enlightenment, modern technocracy, is destructive. The problem is, if they take that argument to its conclusion, they'll be destroying not just technocracy, but industrialization and liberalism as well. And they're not about to do that, and they can't do that. Academia is certainly not about any kind of serious inquiry into these topics. These are mostly endowed chairs at huge corporations called universities. The same universities that are doing much of the scientific research anyway. So, of course, there's a conflict of interest just by itself. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.